Welcome to the From the Vine podcast. I'm your host, Bob Heifel, a reporter and writer of the From the Vine wine column for The Record in Stockton, California. I'm certified level 3 with the Wine and Spirit Education Trust and a part-time tasting room associate at the Lodi Wine and Visitor Center. I hope you enjoy this podcast, which focuses on the Lodi American Viticultural Area. I welcome your comments and reviews on our Facebook group page at recordnet.com/FTV209. And you can follow us at FTV209 on Twitter and Instagram. Welcome to the From the Vine podcast. I'm your host, Bob Heifel of The Record, and it's my great pleasure to have as our guests Steve and William Carson, the brother team behind Drava Wines in Lodi. Guys, great to have you. Thanks for this time together.
Hello, Bob. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, that was Steve, the first Carson that you heard, and then that was William, so we can tell them apart during this podcast. But this is an exciting time for this. Can we still call you guys new? Is that okay, or is that an insult?
In the wine industry, we are new.
Okay. So we can say it. But you've been open for several years now.
Just over three.
Okay, great. But what's significant about the 2017 vintage at Drava Wines, it's the first vintage that has been made here on site, here just off of Turner Road. Steve, as the winemaker, what is kind of the significance in your mind of having the operation here?
Yeah, right. It really is very important. It's all about control. And in our first couple of years as we were starting up, we made our wines at other wineries, and you don't always have the access that you want, or sometimes your host may get a little impatient with you. But when you make your own wine at your own place, you can be as inefficient and very, very patient as you'd like to be.
Right. From a marketing or selling standpoint, are there any advantages to having the production here, William?
I think people always like to see the equipment, the barrels, all that, you know, because you can be a tasting room anywhere. But there's something about breweries and wineries that people like to see, you know, the barrels or the tanks or these things. It kind of gives them an ambiance that they wouldn't get in a restaurant or something like that.
Absolutely. As harvest approaches, it's also nice to have fermenting grapes to show people. And it's interesting showing people bins of reds undergoing fermentation, and they can really see the first steps of winemaking here when it's harvest.
Right. Can you talk about your vineyard sources, Steve? Kind of who you're working with?
Yeah, well, we work with different growers every year. All of our grapes have always been from the Lodi Appellation. However, we do different wines every single year, completely new wines. We don't have the same one back to back. And each year I select maybe 3 or 4 lots of red grapes that I know have blending potential so that when the wines are finished, I can determine if I'd like to maybe find a reserve blend out of them, or if there's just a little bit of blending I can do between them to make them all a little bit better. We definitely try to get certified sustainable Lodi Rules grapes. Almost all of our lots have been that. And then in terms of selection of lots and vineyards, I really try to work with grapes that I've had wines from before in Lodi that I'd like, but that I've never made. Of the 5 wines that I made in 2017, only one of them have I made that variety before. All the rest are new to me. And so it's, for being a small winery, it's neat to be able to just to completely fly off the deep end in terms of where your curiosity might take you and choose some lots of grapes that very few people have had before.
Well, and how exciting to have people come here and visit and have maybe in front of them a completely different flight of wines from vintage to vintage.
Yeah, I think in the case, for example, of the 2017s, the one we have at the top of the list, Pellersen, you know, that's one that basically no one has heard of. And I suppose an advantage, I guess, of selling it here versus in a restaurant or in a shop is that when people encounter wines that they don't know, if it's in a tasting room, they can actually sit there and taste them and talk about them versus seeing them on a wine list or on a shelf and maybe not taking the plunge and be willing to try something new. When you're sitting there pouring it for them and getting to talk it through with them, then people discover new wines that they didn't know and they didn't realize that they like.
Yeah, no, that's such an important point. You know, this may be a wine that you might not shy away from because in a restaurant because you don't want to make a mistake. You don't want to have a wine take a chance on something like that if you're spending money for a meal and let's say you're on a date or with your wife or a significant other, you know, and then you could come here and just try it casually and really get exposed to. That's another great thing about Lodi and what you guys are doing and so many other people is that you can come here and in this appellation visit these wineries and really taste stuff that you've never heard of or tried before. And this variety is certainly up there. Is there anything you'd tell us, Steve, about working with this grape, kind of what it gives you?
Well, it's not like the most ideal story with this grape. I wasn't even really sure I was going to get it, but during fermentation, it was really stinky, actually. Mm-hmm. And I had to work with it a lot to get the sulfides out. And then after I'd done that, it had a little bit of a weird finish to it, kind of like a rubbery finish. And I did a little bit of blending to make that go away. And I'm really surprised with how it came out. I didn't think I would like it as much as I do, considering how it was in its young life. This may be one of those grapes that change a lot as they mature.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, without the track record of having made these wines before, I really don't know. So we'll follow this and see how it goes.
Yeah.
This Pellersen is the one that has emerged from Bottle Shock the first. As you know, we just released these wines this weekend. And there's still a little bit of Bottle Shock showing in some of these wines. But this one is showing very well. It's the lightest of the reds. I don't know if that's a correlation or not. But it's nice and soft and easy drinking red. It's going to go at the top of our list of reds, being the lightest one, the easiest one to start with.
Right. And so I'm going to spell this for people who are not familiar with this variety. It's Pellersen. It's a French grape, French origin, one of the parent grapes of Petite Syrah. It was crossed with Syrah to create a variety that most wine people are familiar with, Petite Syrah, and we grow quite a bit of that here in Lodi. But William, what do you get on this wine? What are some of the things that strike you about it? It's hard to describe,
see, yeah.
Right?
I can say a few things. This one I'm pretty familiar with. It definitely has a pronounced rhubarb smell, which is kind of interesting. It smells a little bit like some stewed vegetables, rhubarb, a little bit of French oak.
Yeah.
Just a touch spicy. It's going to improve. All these wines are going to improve as they further emerge through Bottle Shock. But I think this one will get a little bit more nuanced and complex with a couple more months of age.
Right. How else has been received? I mean, you just got this right this weekend, so.
Yeah, it's been very well received. Yeah. I think, you know, as we were sort of mentioning before, there's a little bit of a risk putting out a wine that people aren't familiar with. But again, because they're sitting here and we get to talk it through with them, it has been received really well. And as Steve mentioned, I think we also were not entirely sure that this one was going to go over well. And I would say of these 2017 so far, and again, this has been the fourth day that we've been pouring them, it has been one of the two that people seem to gravitate to the most. I guess, you know, one thing you were sort of mentioning about Lodi, which is very nice in the sense that all these different kinds of grapes are grown and different wines are made, that I don't know if it's because maybe in some other parts of California, it's harder to experiment with grapes because the risk is too high.
Yeah.
Whereas here in Lodi, okay, if you make something or you plant something and it doesn't go over well, you know, you don't lose the farm, so to speak, and you can do something else. So growers here, you can find all kinds of interesting different grapes that maybe you wouldn't be able to find because it's not worth it. they're not worth growing maybe in other regions of California.
Absolutely. The grower for this, was it Richard Ripken?
Yep, this is Richard.
Okay. You know, it's interesting. There are like certain growers around here you can kind of pick from a short list when you're dealing with some of these really obscure varieties. Richard's one of them.
Richard grew three of these grapes.
Oh, wow. What else did he grow on your own?
He had the Multiple Chiano and the Toraldego also.
Oh, cool. Okay. So Multiple Chiano, those are both Italian varieties. I know Multiple Chiano is, and I think
yeah, the last
Toraldego is as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Multiple Chiano, very famous wine in Italy. Toraldego, it seems like we're seeing more of that here in Lodi.
We are. Yeah, we are. You had one not too long ago over at Peltier. I think that Lange Twins makes one. And Richard bottles his own. Mm-hmm. So that's four right there.
Right. And I think some of the bigger wineries are contracting Toraldego for blending. It seems like it's mm-hmm. a grape that they kind of gravitate toward for its tannin and its really deep, deep color. So
mm-hmm.
Multiple Chiano is on the 2017 list, the Toraldego. Also Sangiovese, of course, the grape in Chianti. And Tempranillo, a Spanish variety. So who grows mm-hmm. the Tempranillo?
Tempranillo is Ron Silva.
Is Ron Silva, okay.
Yeah, he supplies a lot of the Spanish and Portuguese grapes to Lodi.
Yeah, absolutely.
He does a great job. And we're going to work with him again this year.
Oh, great. With the same variety or a different variety?
No, change it up. Okay. It's going to be Malbec this year with him.
Okay, good, good. And then the Sangiovese is from?
That's from Larry Mettler's home vineyard on Harney Lane.
Okay, cool, cool. So you like to mix it up. You like it. Does that make it fun for you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It does make it fun. It makes it a bit challenging. I have to do some research. I also have to be on top of the chemistry, and I have to do lots and lots of tasting as things go along. You know, I have to make my blending decisions. You know, I try mine. I try other people's wines in Lodi. I like to, on weekends, maybe go out to another winery if I have some time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I source some of these. You know, some of these I've just had from other wineries, and I wanted to do it.
Right.
In the case of Multiple Chiano, that's one of Richard Ripken's grapes. Richard had me do a barrel tasting with my brother, and he had this one barrel of Multiple Chiano that he wanted me to try, and I'd never had one before, and I liked it so much, I told him, you know, maybe in a couple of years I'll buy this and I'll mm-hmm. make it myself. So, yeah. And then the reason why he did Tempranillo is a little bit of a different reason. That's because there's a Tempranillo day or weekend in
right.
winter.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to be part of that and see what that's all about.
Very
and,
cool.
Yeah, that's and this is the first Tempranillo I've made.
Awesome. So the Lodi Tour Tempranillo will have Drava on that list.
We hope so. We have to awesome. Arrange all that. That hasn't been organized yet.
Okay. Well, we have time. There's still time for that. Awesome. So Drava wines, when people know the story behind your label, it all kind of comes together as to what the name is about. And your Maribor blend, obviously, has something to do with it. But I want William to kind of tell the story behind the name of the winery and why it is named Drava.
So Drava is a river that starts in northeastern Italy, goes into Austria, then down into Slovenia and then Croatia. And then it joins the Danube to form the border between Croatia and Hungary. And so I lived in a city called Maribor, which is the second biggest town in Slovenia. I lived there 11 years. And this is the town with the oldest grapevine on earth, which is about 450 to 500 years old. And it's on the left bank of the Drava River going through the center of the town of Maribor. So a little over 5 years ago, my brother sent me an email suggesting that I move out here and we start up our own winery.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave it quite a bit of thought and decided it would be a good thing to do. And he was actually the one who had the idea of coming up with some kind of name related to this city. And so I would walk through town and just sort of in my mind say the Slovene names of things I would see, trees and leaves and parks and whatever. And one day I was walking through the center of town and walked past the Drava River, and it seemed like a great name because it's got natural connotations. The oldest grapevine in the world is right on the banks of that river. And very importantly, it has a name that people can sort of wrap their heads around. Because it's not
easy to say.
Yeah, it's not five consonants right. in a row and lots of diacritics and things like mm-hmm. that. So it was a really easy name. A lot of people assume it's our last name, which is understandable, mm-hmm. which of course it's not. But our logo has a small car crossing a bridge over the Drava River. So some people think Drava has some connection with driving, which is understandable, but it doesn't. And yeah, that's where the name came from. And it was just, you know, a combination of sort of our unique story. You know, there's a lot of, you know, all wineries have their own individual story, and uh-huh. ours is a little different from everybody else's. And so we wanted to kind of weave that into the experience of coming in here to the tasting room.
Outstanding. So, Steve, why open a winery?
Well, that is the career arc of any UC Davis viticulture and enology graduate. Mm-hmm. You know, I had worked at a number of wineries in Lodi, and then people who I had worked with were starting to open their own wineries and becoming very successful. And I realized that, you know, I got to jump on board this. And, you know, when I started in Lodi, there were a half a dozen tasting rooms. Now there's 80 or so.
Right.
And so, I mean, the trends are all going in the right direction and things are going so well here. And with my background, I knew that I had just as much ability as anybody else here.
And this isn't your day. Well, this is your day job, but you have a day job.
Yeah, I have another job. I work in the pharmaceutical industry. I'm a scientist, a pharmaceutical lab scientist.
And so that has to come in handy, you know, making wine, fermentation science, and all the.
While stuff. Both are chemistry related and scientific, there's really very little else in common between them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the plan is to transition to this full-time pretty soon.
Okay. And William, you were in Slovenia for 11 years and in Maribor for all 11 of those years? Or was it 9 years? Or
so? Yeah, 2 years I was in Ljubljana, which is the capital, and 9 years in Maribor, the second biggest town.
And tell us what you were doing there.
Well, I had been living in Morocco before that, in Casablanca, and when I was in Casablanca, I was teaching English. And I was teaching English at private language centers, so not an actual public school or something like that. And it being a business, it went out of business. English in Morocco is probably the fifth or sixth most important language. So I had to find another job. So I applied for other jobs in Morocco. I applied for jobs in Algeria, Tunisia, Lebanon, and Syria. And I was offered all of those jobs and decided to take a job in Tunis, the capital of Tunisia. And a couple of months before I was supposed to go out there to start working, I went to Paris and met up with a friend of mine from college. And he was living in Ljubljana, and he knew about this language center in Maribor that needed someone to be the director of it. And I thought, okay, that might be a good option, because prior to Morocco, I had been living in Prague in Czech Republic. So I lived in Europe before. And I kind of came to the realization that maybe living in Europe is better, and you can visit these countries, North Africa and Middle East, that maybe that's sort of a better option than moving to Tunisia. So I ended up moving to Maribor to be the director of this language center. And then I actually ended up getting hired by one of my students, who is the director of an organization called Okolsko Raziskovani Zavod. And this is a nonprofit, non-governmental organization that did environmental and social projects around the country. So about the last 5 years I was there, I was working for this Okolsko Raziskovani Zavod, and then moved here in June of 2014.
Okay. And we should mention that William had the honor of cutting a cluster, the first cluster from that ancient vine that he was describing earlier in our podcast. And that had to be amazing.
Yeah. So this oldest grapevine in the world is owned by the city of Maribor. It's not owned by any person or any vineyard or winery. And essentially how it happened was there was a newspaper article in the newspaper in Maribor, which is called Vecer, and it was about our winery out here in California and a little, some of the details about me living out there also. And when this was published, I thought it would just be something nice to frame and hang on the wall, and it would be a nice decoration for our tasting room. And I really didn't expect it to go any further than that. And one day I woke up and I had an email from the mayor's office in Maribor essentially saying that they had read this article and everyone in Maribor is talking about it, mm-hmm. and that they're so thankful for us being ambassadors of the city of Maribor here in California. And to thank us, they invited me to be the guest of honor at the harvest of this, the 2016 harvest of the, this vine. Which was a very big surprise to me, because having lived there as long as I did, I understand the significance of this. You know, Slovenia is a very, very small country. It's only 2 million people, and they've only been independent ever as a people since 1991. They've never, ever been independent prior to that. Mm. And because of that, they were always sort of a province of some bigger empire or part of Yugoslavia. And because of that, they don't have a lot of monuments or anything. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful country. But, you know, it's not like Paris with the Arc de Triomphe and, you know, Eiffel Tower and things like this. So essentially, this is kind of their treasure, because it's the one thing in the country that they have that is the biggest or the oldest or the, you know, some superlative mm-hmm. that they can use. So when I was invited to do that, of course, I... You know, they didn't have to ask me twice to go out there. And it was the day that it happened. I wish I could relive it and sort of slow everything down, because it really was a whirlwind and it happened. And I just remember afterwards standing there going, well, that was it. That was the most important thing I'll probably yeah. ever do in my entire life. So
you were sick as a dog that day, huh?
Yeah, well, the Slovene people don't need much of an excuse to drink. And because I know a lot of people out there, this was maybe the sixth or seventh day of that trip. So it was sort of the sixth or seventh consecutive New Year's Eve type right. night I had had. And I remember lying in bed that morning in the hotel thinking, if I was being asked to get out of bed for anything other than being the guest of honor at the harvest of the world's oldest grapevine, I would probably say no thank you and not right. stay in bed all day.
Awesome. Great story. Great honor. So we're trying the Tempranillo right now. It's Steve poured, or William poured, actually, or whoever. Someone poured it. It's in my glass. Who cares who poured it? Beautiful nose on this. How is this to work with?
Yeah, this was also a bit of a challenge. It pressed out at a pH of about 4.4, which is very, very high. Mm-hmm. And it has a reputation of being a very low acid wine, but it needs a lot of barrel and bottle age. And those are sort of contrasting forces that just make wine difficult to make. Mm-hmm. I gave it a whole bunch of tartaric acid to the point where it just didn't taste like it could handle anymore. And then it just started tasting like battery acid, really strange. Mm-hmm. And this lot of Tempranillo that Ron Silva grew, Rick at Riaza made the same wine, and oh, okay. we picked up the grapes at the same time. And so I was asking him some advice about this, and mm-hmm. he says you just have to be patient. Mm-hmm. And so I just waited it out.
Yeah.
And it true to everything I've read and heard, it just takes some patience, and you do the best you can. Mm-hmm. You know, on this list we have Tempranillo and Sangiovese, and both are medium-bodied, kind of rustic, old-world wines. Mm-hmm. Tempranillo is a very low-acid version of that, and Sangiovese is a pretty high-acid yes. version of that. Mm-hmm. So I just did I did a little bit of blending between the two to try to balance out that acidity between them without losing the individual character of each wine. And that was another tool that I had to help me get this done. And this one, it opens up with some little bit of air. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of a sign of bottle shock. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's definitely rustic and earthy, as is often described. It also has some violets on the nose.
Definitely.
A little cherry, a little tobacco and leather.
Yeah, kind of the telltale Tempranillo characteristics. Mm-hmm. But I think kind of in a softer, more approachable package than...
Well, it's still fairly low acid.
Yeah. So this is 13.6 on the alcohol and small lot, 50 cases. So come get this.
Everything that we made last year or the last 2 years has been either a half ton or one ton. Mm. And that's kind of where we are as a winery. We buy half ton and one ton lots. So half ton gives you 25 cases, one ton gives you 50 cases. And, you know, when I blend back and forth, those numbers might change a little bit, but that's how small we are.
Mm-hmm.
But
very nice.
Since we are making the wines at our own winery, I can't afford to have these very small, inconvenient lots and work with them and give them lots of attention. And one thing that I also am very happy to do with the inefficiency is we give these a lot of punch downs. Mm. During fermentation, I'll get here in the morning, I'll do a series of punch downs. Then William comes in to run the tasting room, and he'll do them throughout the day. And then late at night, I'll come in and do one more. And, you know, during the peak of fermentation, these could get up to like 8 punch downs a day, 6 to 8. And that's a lot.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to get as much extraction as possible.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, good.
And you can really tell that throughout these wines in the texture.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them are tannic, but they all have a nice extracted texture to mm-hmm. them.
There's a nice tannin and structure on the Tempranillo, for sure. So is this the Sangiovese? A little more?
Yep. Now this one really has a nice texture.
Yeah, it has a beautiful nose.
Yeah. It's a little light on the color. I know it was darker in barrel.
Mm-hmm.
It should bounce back a little bit in terms of color.
Well, you said this too. These were just bottled, so
yeah. These were bottled. What was it? A couple months ago?
3 months?
Yeah, 3 months ago.
A little early May, I think.
Yeah, and that's kind of the bottle shock period. About 3 months. You know, it's nice when they get past the bottle shock period and start getting into the bottle age, a bottle bouquet curve. That's when they really start getting nice. And I also look forward very much to entering these into some competitions. I think that these have some good potential.
Good. You got for the 16 Grenache, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is.
The 15th from the San Francisco Chronicle Wine Competition. First entry into that.
Yeah, that was our first entry. And so we also, where's our California State? Oh, yeah, we have a California State Fair ribbon for that wine also. And yeah, we did great. For our very first entries, we got some bronzes and silvers from those. And I am pretty sure that the wines that I have made here, both these newly bottled and the 2018s in barrel right now, mm-hmm. are just as good, if not better.
So are you in the throes of harvest right now?
No, we haven't started yet.
Uh-huh.
I don't know actually exactly when we are starting. No growers have given me any reports. I would imagine the first one we'll get in is the white we'll be doing this year, Grenache Blanc that Fields grows. Mm. And I think maybe tomorrow I'll call up Ryan Sherman and ask him how things are looking out there. Mm. But this year, this vintage, I think is going to be very similar to last year's vintage,
uh-huh.
where if you're doing reds, it's going to be a late harvest. All the growers are telling me that it looks like they're about 10 days later than normal. And that's about what last year was. Okay. And so what's nice about that is that when the weather starts cooling down, you know, when you're crushing and pressing, when the weather's cool in the morning, it makes it much more bearable. When it's a hot day outside doing that, it's tough work.
It's real tough. It's tough regardless, but you're right. On a 100-degree or 90-degree day, mm-hmm. It's really super tough. So good. Well, I like all of them. I like the Sangiovese. It has a nice acidic backbone, as it's described here. I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
This is your quintessential Italian food wine,
mm-hmm. because of that acid. It's really, really, really delicious. Montepulciano is another Italian variety.
Montepulciano is, you know, a lot of people know the name. There's a grape Montepulciano, uh-huh. which is from the region of Abruzzo, mm-hmm. and the wine, the Vino Nobile di Montepulciano, which is Sangiovese, which is Tuscan. So this one is the Abruzzo grape called Montepulciano.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, okay. So this is not the grape Montepulciano. This is...
No, it is the grape Montepulciano.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, which is not Tuscan, but it is from... Abruzzo.
Okay.
The Tuscan wine that people know with the name of Montepulciano is a Sangiovese-based wine, and it's named after the Tuscan town of Montepulciano, and it's, I think, called Vino Nobile di Montepulciano.
Right.
So this is the actual grape. So Abruzzo is a little bit further south. If you went from Tuscany to Umbria to Marche, the next one to the south would be Abruzzo. And this is on the Adriatic coast. So sort of... If you were essentially to go from Rome east, kind of cutting across Italy, you would more or less, maybe that may not be exactly right, but more or less get to this Abruzzo region. So it's mm-hmm. southern, but not very, it's not like Puglia or Campania, and it's not that far south, uh-huh. but it's also not north like Piemonte or Alto Adige.
Adige, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find Italy very difficult to study. Because of the, just the different, there's so many different grape varieties and indigenous varieties, synonyms, just a lot of them. And it's for an old guy like me to try to keep all that straight. But they sure make great wine grapes. And these grow really well in our climates and soils here in Lodi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one, the Montepulciano, it was hit the hardest with bottle shock. And this is quite interesting as I try this right now, because last weekend we did that little preview couple hours at the visitor center where I opened these wines up for people who just happened to be there. And it was a lot more regressed than this is now just a week later. It's coming through more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm definitely getting more. It was the one that was hit the hardest, and my two favorite wines in barrel of this vintage were Teroldego and Montepulciano. And up until like really just now, the Montepulciano is the one showing the least to me. But I'm getting some of what I remember in barrel now. It has just a lot of very hedonistic flavors and smells to it. It's got fruit and spice and like a little bit of everything.
Yeah, because there's definitely floral component.
It's got some floral stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my tasting notes here on the list don't say very much because it was really bottle shocked when I wrote this. But I have lots of notes in barrel, and I have them kind of internalize what I'm expecting out of these.
Can you describe bottle shock to folks who may not know?
Oh, yeah. Well, bottle shock is simply when you bottle wines, they regress. They like... just like a lot of the nice aromatics especially just drop right out. Uh-huh. And what's left are anything that's chemical inside the wine. So it's a lot of sulfites and alcohol that you smell without the, you know, the fruit flavors, the spiciness, the even the oak. They all get pushed way down. And in the case of these wines, they are all unfiltered, unfined, very minimally handled. All we did for bottling is we drove them, the barrels over to the winery that bottled them with us and just pumped them from barrel into a bottling tank and then from the bottling tank into the filler. And that's all the movement that it saw. I did bump the sulfites up quite a bit, which is very common. You want to try to hit a certain parts per million concentration of sulfites right before bottling because you can't add them after it's bottled. So you have to hit them kind of hard, and that also furthers the bottle shock phenomenon. And then it just takes time for those sulfites to start to integrate, and for whatever reason, just the very slight shock of bottling for that to wear off. And there's not a whole lot of rhyme or reason. Sometimes it's just like a month. Sometimes it's like 6 months.
We're laughing. We're listening to Steve, obviously, but William nailed the location.
I'm glad. I had to double check, but it looks like I was correct.
He looked at the map and drew the line across with his finger and gave it a thumbs up. So we're good. Okay.
In case any of you are on your way to Abruzzo, land at Fiumicino in Rome and head east.
One of these days. One of these days.
You can tell that this one has a little more extraction, a little more ripeness on the in the mouth. And as many wineries, including ours, when we develop a tasting list, is generally for the reds, your lightest to your heaviest. And this being the second to last one, it's picking up the concentration a bit more. Mm.
.9 on the alcohol, and it's just 75 cases, so again, come and get it. And then the last wine on the list here is the 17 Teraldigo. Now, this was a grape kind of with an interesting history. I'm not sure I'm an expert on it, but from what I understand or talk to people about, I'm getting Teraldigo and Charbono confused in my mind. So Charbono was a grape that Napa and Sonoma produced a pretty good amount of back in the day.
Yeah.
And then it kind of fell out of favor. I think Inglenook grew a lot of Charbono.
Okay.
In fact, there is a 3-acre plot in Lodi behind the Langford Estate, which Lorraine Pasquette has now, that's planted to Charbono that might have been cuttings from Inglenook, but that's neither here nor there. Mm-hmm. Teraldigo, really, what, inky, very dark, rich looking in the glass.
Yeah, these are the kinds of wines I like.
Yeah.
It is also going through the last throes of bottle shock, but when it's fully through, it has an incredible aftertaste. Just real silky and very long. It reminds me of like warm brownies with like raspberry sauce drizzled on it. That cocoa kind of mouthfeel mimics the tannins in wine, and that's where I get that similarity. But this one seems to be the favorite. This and the Pellerson, as William mentioned. We almost sold out of it today. Mm. We only have a couple cases here.
Yeah, we didn't sell out of everything we made, but everything that we had brought over from the warehouse. Yeah, I underestimated how much people would like this one.
Well, that's great. Good problem to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I hope that's one of our biggest problems in the future.
But of the wines we've tried, this by far has the most tannin.
Oh, yeah.
The most structure.
This is one of those wines where 24 hours after crushing, you know it's going to be a dark wine. Mm-hmm. Usually the juice starts off kind of green. And maybe slightly rusty. This one was fully colored one day after harvest.
And you know, you had spoken about the punch downs earlier. This, when we did the punch downs of this Teraldigo, because the skin of the grape is so thick, because it's an alpine grape, I suppose that's the reason. But when you did the punch downs with this Teraldigo, it was noticeably, the cap that had formed was noticeably denser and more resistant when you were doing the punch downs. Mm. It took a lot more arm work to get that to...
A lot more muscle to get that punch down.
Yeah, what's interesting is that this one has the lowest of the alcohol.
Yeah, and that's
yet kind the of biggest body.
Counterintuitive, right?
Yeah, it is.
13.1.
Mm-hmm.
25 cases.
Yeah, this is one we just got a half ton of.
Rutherford Cab in your notes, kind of as a comparison.
Yeah.
Is that the dustiness, maybe?
It's the eucalyptus.
The eucalyptus.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know what? It's not quite as Rutherford Cab now as it was in the first couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be settling more into what I got in the barrel. But the Rutherford Cab is just a lot of eucalyptus and a Cabernet character, and that's sort of going away. And what's replacing it is what it was more in barrel.
I see.
Yeah, these, you know, I'm probably going to have to go back and rewrite these tasting notes once they really start getting to that bottle aging curve.
And they're kind of settled, kind of where they
can. Yeah, I mean, I've written a lot of tasting notes. There's ones on the back label that I wrote separately that are probably a little bit more true than what is on the tasting list. This one on the label I describe as rose petals, raspberry compote, and brownie aftertaste.
Hmm.
And that's more, that seems to more closely describe it than what I have on the tasting list, which is comparing it to Rutherford Cabernet.
Yeah.
has a beautiful color.
This one. It does. Yeah, 12 to go. Really, really nice deep color.
I've been a little bit surprised when, once we started sort of talking about how we were bottling this Terroir de Go and releasing it, that people know this grape for sure. You know, for Italian grapes, of course, it's not like Sangiovese or, you know, to that level of recognition. Mm-hmm. But people got very excited to hear that we were coming out with a Terroir de Go. And it sounds like maybe it's something that... while being, I suppose, still a small grape in terms of production versus some of the better-known grapes, it's got quite a following. The people who like it are really, really crazy about it. So
cool. This is, we're going to be making that again in this year. The plan was I wanted to make Alianico this year, and I couldn't find the grapes. And if anybody knows where some is available in Lodi, please let me know. But I had to look for another grape to replace it, and I went back to Terroir de Go. However, this year I'll be buying it from Todd Maley. And so he brought us a bottle of something he'd made himself before Terroir de Go, and it was really, really nice. So we'll be doing that again.
What do you have in barrel right for 18?
Yeah, 18 and... I'm glad you asked because I want to bring it up. Yeah, so it's going to be completely different. Not just obviously the grapes. I said those are different, but in terms of the style, very, very different. I wanted to go with like the grapes that I just consider the classic Lodi Reds, the ones that do best when they're super ripe, really big, and just like full blown. I don't know if everybody will like them, but it's just what I wanted to do. So I did two Old Vine Zins, Todd Maley's and the Moore Fry, Petite Syrah from Moore Fry, and Syrah from Mettler, and a half ton of Primitivo from Greg Lewis up in Clements.
All right.
So we're pushing like 15, 16 alcohol on some of these wines. They're all dry, but they're just huge and concentrated and dark and super tannic. And they're going to be very showy.
Awesome. So, William, tell us how people can get here. Where are you located for tasting, phone numbers, website addresses, all that good stuff?
All right. In terms of coming to visit us, we are 1378 East Turner Road. So that is about a half mile east of Highway 99 on Turner Road. We are on the south side of Turner Road. So just... look hard. Sometimes it takes people a couple of passes by to find us, but
it's worth it.
Be diligent, we ask you.
Yeah.
Phone number is 209-400-5009. The website is Drava Wines, plural, so DRAVAWINES.com. You can also find us on social media at Drava Wines, so Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And we're open Thursday through Monday, so obviously closed Tuesday, Wednesday. And we're open also days like Labor Day and Memorial Day. When those fall on Mondays, we're always open for those days.
Okay.
And we're open 11 to 5. Yeah.
Come on out. It's really great. You guys are doing a wonderful job. Congratulations. Continued success.
Cool. Thanks, Bob.
My pleasure. Thanks for being with us on the From the Vine podcast.